Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. FBI agent defends his actions in contentious House testimony. The embattled former FBI agent Peter Strzok, who oversaw the opening of the Russia investigation, mounted an aggressive personal defense on Thursday, rejecting accusations that he let his private political views bias his official actions and labeling Republican attacks on him another victory notch in Putin's belt. Here is former Agent Strzok responding to a statement by Congressman Trey Gowdy.
Your testimony is Bob Mueller did not kick you off because of the content of your text. He kicked you off because of some appearance that he was worried about. Sure.
My testimony, what you asked and what I responded to, was that he kicked me off because of my bias. I'm stating to you it is not my understanding that he kicked me off because of any bias, that it was done based on the appearance. If you want to represent what you said accurately, I'm happy to answer that question, but I don't appreciate what was originally said being changed.
I don't give a damn what you appreciate, Agent Strzok. I don't appreciate having an FBI agent with an unprecedented level of animus working on two major investigations during 2016.
I can assure you, Mr. Chairman, at no time in any of these texts did those personal beliefs ever enter into the realm of any action I took. Furthermore, this isn't just me sitting here telling you. You don't have to take my word for it. At every step, at every investigative decision, there are multiple layers of people above me, the assistant director, executive assistant director, deputy director, and director of the FBI, and multiple layers of people below me, section chiefs, supervisors, unit chiefs, case agents, and analysts, all of whom were involved in all of these decisions. They would not tolerate any improper behavior in me any more than I would tolerate it in them. That is who we are as the FBI. And the suggestion that I, in some dark chamber somewhere in the FBI, would somehow cast aside all of these procedures, all of these safeguards, and somehow be able to do this is astounding to me. It simply couldn't happen. And the proposition that that is going on, that it might occur anywhere in the FBI, deeply corrodes what the FBI is in American society, the effectiveness of their mission, and it is deeply destructive.
Now, this so-called hearing is a total waste of time. I am more than aware of the history of the FBI. I'm no fan of the FBI. I understand the COINTELPRO program and other machinations by the FBI and other agencies, especially how the FBI has used its power to undermine the civil rights movement, the Southern Freedom Movement, and other struggles. The possible, if not probable, link between the FBI and the assassinations of civil rights leaders. Former Agent Strzok was stupid. Using his government-issued cell phone to send the messages he did was stupid, reckless, and irresponsible. And I also have no idea why he would try to tie Russian President Putin into this whole thing. But anyway, in listening to today's testimony, there is absolutely no direct link. No evidence was presented to show a link or causation between the personal messages sent by Strzok and actions taken by him or anyone else in the FBI. Does former Agent Strzok like Trump? No, that's pretty clear. But the hypocrisy of the Republicans continues to be nauseating. At NATO, Trump claims allies make new defense spending commitments after he upends summit. In the closing hours of the two-day gathering in Brussels with leaders of the other NATO nations, Trump forced a last-minute emergency meeting to address his grievances over spending. Then he called a news conference to claim credit for having pressured NATO members to boost their defense budgets, quote, like they never have before. End quote. The problem with his assertion is that it's just not true. It's a lie. His assertion of new expenditure commitments was swiftly contradicted by French President Emmanuel Macron and Italy's Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte when German Chancellor Angela Merkel gave only a vague assurance that her country needed to do more. No sooner had Trump departed the summit than some of the other leaders suggested that the alliance had only agreed to redouble efforts to boost spending without making any commitments. So even if they had agreed to up their expenditures, those are not guarantees. They are only goals or guidelines. So again, if what Trump said was true, and again, it's not, he got from NATO leaders the same deal he got from Chairman Kim Jong-un of North Korea. No commitment. He got a bunch of warm and fuzzy, all sizzle and no steak. And that's the art of the deal? Oh, here's another point. Trump needs to bone up on checks and balances. He was asked at a press conference while in Brussels if he could unilaterally withdraw from NATO. He said he thought he could pull the U.S. out of NATO without congressional approval. Well, the Constitution provides that the president shall have power by and with the advice and consent of the Senate to make treaties, provided two-thirds of the senators present concur. That's Article 2, Section 2. The Constitution's framers gave the Senate a share of the treaty power in order to give the president the benefit of the Senate's advice and counsel, check presidential power, and safeguard the sovereignty of the states by giving each state an equal vote in the treaty-making process. North Korea stands up U.S. in meeting over war debt. Speaking of Trump, got from the NATO leaders the same deal he got from Chairman Kim Jong-un of North Korea, no commitment. So Trump releases the letter from Kim Jong-un, and he touts great progress. It's a nice letter. Kim writes, quote, "I firmly believe that the strong will, sincere efforts, and unique approach of myself and Your Excellency, Mr. President, aimed at opening up a new future between the DPRK and the U.S. will surely come to fruition," end quote. There's one word that's missing from this entire letter, and that word is denuclearization. It's interesting that now North Koreans, the way that the story's been reported, that the North Koreans failed to show up to a meeting with U.S. counterparts today, and it's alleged this is delivering the second blow within a week to the Trump administration's efforts to make headway on denuclearization talks. Now, remember, it was reported that Pompeo was supposed to meet with Kim on his last visit, but Kim was at a potato farm picking potatoes in a very nice summer white jacket, I might add. But there's an interesting point in how this whole story is being reported. We're told that the U.S. delegation was stood up in the demilitarized zone on the Korean Peninsula today to discuss the return of the remains of U.S. soldiers that were killed during the Korean War. Yonhap News Agency reported U.S. military officials were left waiting at the border without advance word from Pyongyang. Later in the story, it is reported, Pompeo, who announced the meeting following his third visit to Pyongyang, had already warned it could move by one day or two. An official said the meeting was now likely to go ahead at the weekend. So instead of being stood up, this really just sounds more like a bit of confusion than a direct attempt to insult. Sue Mi Terry, a former Korea analyst with the CIA, said it was another insult to the U.S. by the North Koreans following Pompeo's cold reception in Pyongyang. The fact that they, quote, "the fact that they all are not willing to cooperate on an innocuous matter like the remains is a sign that they are playing hardball," said Ms. Terry. "President Trump claimed victory prematurely. In fact, there is no sign that North Korea is disarming," end quote. So all of that may be true. It may not be, but it may be. But how Ms. Terry gets all of this from a meeting that did not take place when Pompeo warned it could move by one day or two, to me, is a bit of a stretch. Two things. One, you have to be a very, very discerning reader and listener. Two, it really sounds like there are competing forces in the administration. Pompeo, who was trying to work a deal, and the Bolton crew, who would really prefer the Libyan option. You're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. As we discussed on Tuesday, the National Football League Players Association filed a grievance challenging the NFL's newly imposed national anthem policy, according to the union. The complaint is, quote, on behalf of all players challenging the NFL's recently imposed anthem policy, end quote. The Players Association, they said in a statement, the union's claim is that this new policy imposed by the NFL's governing body without consultation with the Players Association is inconsistent with the collective bargaining agreement. What does this mean? Well, to get insight into this and other issues, we're going to turn to my first guests. He is currently on the adjunct faculty at Howard University School of Law and the Wharton Business School of the University of Pennsylvania, where he teaches sports law. He's practiced sports law for 29 years, during which he has been a certified agent for NFL players for 15. He is Mason Ash. Welcome to the Critical Hour.
Hello, sir.
Thank you for joining us. We're also joined by the founder, CEO of Brand Architects, where for over two decades, the company has worked to develop brand integration, personal and business management, and partnership building for NFL, NBA, and various celebrity clients. He is Anton Barnes. Good evening, Mr. Barnes.
Good evening. How are you doing today?
Doing great, and thank you both again for joining us. Let's start with Mason. So please explain what's going on here.
I think the basic point is more of a procedural matter because I think the NFL is trying to impose a new rule without perhaps going through the processes and the due process that the players believe they deserve when it comes to material issues in the collective bargaining agreement. I don't think that the owners can get together and decide on certain material parts of the collective bargaining without the consultation and input of the players' union. So we're into this battle of whether or not they pass the rule the right way.
Anton, if you could please, first of all, your thoughts to the same question I gave Mason, your thoughts, and then talk about it from a branding perspective and the impact that these protests were having on the brand.
Well, I believe what Mason just said is a valid point. The collective bargaining agreement is supposed to be a partnership, but it seems like, you know, the owners are trying to take this somewhat of a dictatorship approach, i.e. feeling the pressure from Trump. And let's just be honest here, some of his ignorant base. So the players, honestly, from a player standpoint, from a branding standpoint, yes, they're trying to tarnish the player's brand, but in retrospect, it's actually bringing the players together because everyone's missing the whole point of the protest. It was never about the flag. It was never about protesting the flag. It was actually about using the platform, protesting issues in society that, you know, African-Americans have to deal with on a daily basis. And some of the players actually have dealt with on a personal level, whether they personally have gone through it or family members. So,
a la Michael Bennett.
There you go. Exactly. And, you know, since we deal with athletes in their philanthropy work and community work, everyone's missing the point that these guys actually do more work in the community than our so-called president and his followers. So, you know, me personally, I think it's just a tarnishing tactic that the league, I guess you could just say the owners are feeling the pressure to kind of do something. And I think it was reactionary, and it was just something to kind of, I guess you could just say, pacify what the president was saying.
From a branding perspective, if you could just quickly talk a bit about the impact that the protests or the perception that the impact of the protests was having on the NFL brand.
Yeah, on the NFL brand, yes, it was making an impact because, you know, viewership was going down. But a lot of people lose the point or miss the fact that a lot of people were not tuning in because of the treatment of Kaepernick. It wasn't just because it was the issue of the protest. A lot of people were tuning out because of the treatment of Kaepernick.
I'm one of those people. I will not watch the NFL for nothing. I'm done.
Exactly. So, you know, the powers that be are trying to say, oh, see, the ratings are down because people are mad because they're protesting. That's not true. And TV ratings actually were going down because, and see, people don't know this. You know, a lot of people, you know, Thursday Night Football, you know, they're putting some, from a branding standpoint for the NFL, they were putting some bad product out there. People don't want to watch Thursday Night Football. Okay, they were putting subpar games on with subpar teams. So the ratings were down a little bit, but not that much of an impact. But what really made the impact and was the initial protest were people tuning out for the Kaepernick treatment.
I'm glad that you mentioned the original intent of the protest. It's interesting how Cap's silent and peaceful protest against police brutality and murder was turned into this anti-flag and anti-military campaign, when the reality is the NFL's connection to the military is a paid-for marketing campaign. It's not that the NFL owners decided that football and patriotism go hand in hand. The Army decided to buy time during games to promote the military. It's contrived patriotism. It's straight marketing, homie. I mean, that's all this is. Mason, your thoughts?
Well, you know, I don't know. I think I see it from the side of the advisor and counselor of the players. The players have a tough position because, you know, we teach them to not just make money and take care of your family, but also to be socially conscious. And then when they try to exercise that consciousness, then there's a lot of bickering as to how they do it. And so you got to remember, you know, most of these players have never taken a socially conscious course doing what they feel. And Kaepernick and those who support him, or those who support the right that he has to be expressive politically, even if they don't agree with his position, or even understand what the origin was of his activity was in the beginning. You know, this is a league of brotherhood, and there are players who stick together. They stick with each other when people attack them. And I think some of the players were on his side and on the side of right here when the president got involved and others got involved and made it into this divisive issue. They won't be divided. So it's a tough situation for players, whether they believe politically that there is police brutality or if there is discrimination, and those who don't see it that are outside our community and believe that, you know, this is a colorblind society, this is a post-racial society, thanks to Obama administration or regime. You know, it is interesting that there's so many different political views between the fans and the players, and the fans just want the players to shut up and play. And I hated that when I saw that on social media. A lot of white people that you respect were really concerned about their entertainment value more than what the players were trying to communicate and use the platform that we've taught them to use for good. So it's a tough situation when players have trained their whole lives to make it to the league, and then now they want to be silenced because no one wants them to exercise their political right.
That whole shut up and play, that came before it got to social media. I think that came from Fox News. I can't remember the Fox News woman's name who made the statement, but I'm going to put this to Mason because you are a certified agent. So this is my opinion and this is my perception. It was Laura Ingraham. Thank you. It was Laura Ingraham from Fox that made that ridiculous statement. So Mason, I'm going to put this to you. I'm giving you my opinion and my perception, and so help me if I'm wrong. And then, Anton, I'll ask you to respond. You mentioned the players' cohesiveness, but my perception is they left Kaepernick hanging. Had the players come out the following week with either a number 7 on an armband or some type of show of unity and collective mindset, I think that demonstration would have served them not only in terms of supporting Kaepernick, but would have demonstrated to the owners that this is a true union of players and that that would have benefited them when the next collective bargaining agreement comes to the table. I think the players left Kaepernick hanging.
Well, first of all, I was a certified agent for 15 years, 10 years ago, and mm-hmm. I'm a certified in the NBA now.
Okay.
But I think that I'm not sure I agree that they left them hanging. I think we perceive them as fans from outside the league. We look in from the outside in, and we see a group of people who should be more, I guess, cooperative and bound together. But, you know, these are individuals who have all come from different backgrounds, different types of circumstances, and they are all very focused and disciplined athletes first. And then this stuff comes on their plate that some of them are more willing to express publicly. Some of them are more private about it. It's almost like religion. Some people are more open about it. Some people are not. And so there really isn't this natural organic bond. I mean, you may have a union and you have union meetings, but you know, not everybody's focused on those things. Some of those guys are focused on keeping a job and taking care mm-hmm. of employees and everything else that's involved in their lives. And then they start to, you know, hear more and more that there's this conflict going on and some of their colleagues are being attacked. And then they kind of focus on it, you know, so I don't think that they would have reacted as fast as you stated the following week if they all had collectively done something. I don't think they're, you know, they're,
well, I used the week, just I kind of, whether it was a week or 2 weeks, they still have not collectively, as I can see, and again, this is my perception, and you're a hell of a lot closer to it than I am. So if I'm wrong, I respect it. I respect your pushback. They still collectively have not supported the brother, and especially when and Anton, I'll come to you. Especially when the president came out and made the statement about throw all the SOBs off the field, and then when the union came, Now the NFL came out and said, you can't protest. Oh, really? We can't? Well, let us show you what will happen when we do protest. You can't suspend us all.
I believe what Mason said is a valid point. You know,
okay.
Individuals, you have individuals who are, let's just be honest here, who are more outspoken or leaders
mm-hmm.
than others. It got to the point where players were actually more interested in letting their actions do the speaking for them instead of words. They just got tired. You know, we have clients that were, I'm going to just revert to some of our clients that play on the Philadelphia Eagles. Recently, you know, they didn't want to go to the White House. And then, of course, Trump made another statement and just went on one of his tantrums again. And, you know, the players chose to just ignore him. I think that a lot of people get so caught up with this man's chatter and just continue to give him fuel to just spread his divisiveness. And our players have actually, the players that we represent have decided to let their actions speak louder than just sitting there wasting their time talking to this man. And in regards to Kaepernick, we have players that are part of the Malcolm Jenkins Coalition. And, you know, we have players that actually speak to Kaepernick, but they're private about it. They don't want the public to know, and they don't believe that the public needs to know because they're out there actually donating to Kaepernick's causes. They're also donating to their own causes.
Mm-hmm.
All of our clients represent are either spokespersons, have 501c3s, whatever it is that deals with whether it's educational issues, health issues, a number of philanthropy aspects that was always the first, which was always the main focus from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And we believe that, okay, we're not going to get caught up with the, let's just, I'm going to just be blunt, the ignorant talk and just let the action speak. Because when the president fired this back up, players weren't even talking about, I'll be honest, they weren't even talking about protesting. Like everybody, nobody was talking about taking any next year. They weren't even talking about that. They were like, oh, we're going to move past that. We actually want to focus on our community. And that's what was the main focus in the beginning. And I just want to bring up one point.
Sure.
I think people really forget, I think, honestly, and this is kind of a fact, I think that Trump is really using this as a manipulation tactic because his good friend Vince McMahon is coming with a new league. He's bringing the XFL back in 2020. So he's basically manipulating his base off the NFL and tune into Vince McMahon's league, where he is the sole owner of all of the teams. No player could protest. It's pretty much a dictatorship league that he's trying to fire up, which I personally think is going to fail. So I think a lot of people miss that aspect in this as well, too.
It's going to fail the same way. And this is something, too, that I haven't heard a lot of people talk about. And then I want to move on to the Papa John issue real quick, is that we have these owners who are now acquiescing to Trump when he wanted to buy into the NFL and they rejected his bid. And that's why he started the USFL. And that folded like so many other of Trump's businesses.
Exactly. And then his buddy is Vince McMahon.
Here we go.
So failed before. He's trying to bring it back in 2020. Those are his intentions. And it's the opposite of the NFL. There's no personal foul leagues. It's going to basically be a street baller form of degraded football.
It's going to be mixed martial arts on the gridiron.
WWE on the field.
So real quick, and let me come back here to Mason. Papa John's founder quits as chairman of Papa John's, using the N-word during a conference call. The founder of Papa John's Pizza, John Schnatter, however you pronounce his name, he resigns after Schnatter. There we go. Okay. All right. Like it matters. He resigns after using racial slurs about African Americans during a conference call. And so I just wanted to, a lot of folks weren't aware of this, and this seems to be tangentially at least discussable under the what the NFL is trying to do with the players.
No, what would be the connection you're saying?
No, I was saying I'm talking about it because I think there is a connection between the two. There's a tangential relationship between Schnatter referring to African Americans in the context that he is, and you have African American players on the field protesting, and now you're looking at what the owners are trying to do to shut the protest down.
Well, I think that's
and he blames the players for why his sales have gone down because of the protest during the anthem.
Right. Yeah. I think that's all a lot of noise. And if he did use that word, he should be punished for that and feel some repercussions for sure. But as far as it being a connection, the owners of the league, I believe, are all into this to make money. They want to make money. All of them are not necessarily Trump followers or friends. Or like you said, they didn't even let him buy a team. So I don't believe that they are truly Trump supporters, if you will. I believe that they want to continue not to tarnish their brand, this money machine they have. They have in their minds a great game that they would like to see continue, hopefully safer than it has in the past. But I don't think that they're as focused on some of these political things as you know, the attention has brought us to lately. I think they want to make more money. They want to figure out more ways to make more money. And as the pie expands and grows, the players participate on a percentage of the collective bargaining that allows them to do so with salary cap. So, you know, as the money flows in, the players get the benefit. And so they are all on the same side of making money. I don't think that it is the divisive environment that some believe. I know there are some owners, more than likely, that old school owners who may have outdated thoughts about their relationship with their employees on the team, the players being property versus an employee or a partner. There's no doubt there's some older owners that may look at them as property and would like to shut them up and get them more focused on making them more money, you know. So that may exist, but that's not across the board. I mean, a lot of the general managers, a lot of the coaches, most of them, in fact, and you don't find, you know, some of the outdated thoughts that we are hearing about. But, yeah, there are definitely some old school owners that are caught in another time warp that would really like to, you know, not necessarily promote the self-expression of players' rights.
Anton, Schnatter tried to downplay his remarks by saying that Colonel Sanders called Black's N-words, and he never faced a public rebuke. And then he also reflected on his early life in Indiana, where he said people used to drag African Americans from trucks until they died. And he was saying that he was trying to convey his antipathy to racism, but it seems to me that he wasn't really communicating antipathy as much as affinity. Papa John's has been tied very closely to the NFL. So from a branding perspective, your take on this?
Well, you know, there are actually a couple of NFL players. Yeah, Peyton Manning. Actually, Malcolm Jenkins owned a couple of Papa John's. So it doesn't look good. It doesn't look good. You know, when you have an individual, you know, making statements like that publicly, and from what I understand isn't the first time, there's an issue. And it just goes to show you in regards to what this person's beliefs or his mind state is when you continually make statements like that. So from a branding standpoint, I mean, from what I heard, Papa John's sales were going down prior to the protest. So I think he's just using it as a scapegoat and just trying to place blame on them. Me personally, I don't know a lot of people that eat Papa John's personally, but
I don't either.
Me either.
So I think he's just trying to blame somebody else for his failures.
Mason Ash, Anton Barnes, thank you both for your time this evening. We really appreciate you coming to the Critical Hour.
My pleasure.
Thank you, gentlemen. Look forward to having you back. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot.
You're listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. It's been reported that the U.S. Department of Justice is reopening the Emmett Till investigation almost 63 years after his murder. The federal government has quietly revived its investigation into the murder of Emmett Till, the 14-year-old African-American young man who was abducted and killed almost 63 years after the event. He was murdered on August 28, 1955 in Money, Mississippi. That was 4 years before I was born. But his death was so horrific and its impact so pervasive that it's one of those events that has been seared into my memory as if I was alive when it happened. To get greater insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's a journalist. He's an author, a lecturer. He's a founding member of Malcolm X's Organization of Afro-American Unity, OAAU, where he was editor of the OAAU newsletter, Blacklash. From 1968 to 1975, he worked as associate editor for Ebony Magazine. His vitae is as long as my arm. So all I need to say, really, is, ladies and gentlemen, it is an honor for me to introduce Mr. A. Peter Bailey. Welcome to the Critical Hour.
And thank you very much.
Well, thank you for your time. And let me say right now, I look forward to bringing you back. Your thoughts on the news that the Department of Justice is reviving its investigation into the murder of Emmett Till?
I'm totally unimpressed. They knew 2 days after that. They knew probably by the evening that happened who killed Emmett Till. So I don't, you know, this is to me, I'm not even, it's just ridiculous. It's ridiculous. That they I don't know what this is all about. I don't know what they think they're going to gain. The people who did it are all dead now. Emmett Till's mother is dead. I don't know what they plan to. Are they going to give some kind of retribution to the family? I don't know. But other than for that reason, I see absolutely nothing except PR for them to be doing that in 2018.
Is this really the Trump administration sleeves off their vest kind of thing, trying to demonstrate some type of connection to the African-American community, saying, look at what we're going to reopen and investigate, when everybody that was involved, with the exception of probably two or three people, to your point, are dead. They're not going to put anybody else in prison. So what's the point?
There's nothing to investigate, Dr. Leon.
Mm-hmm.
They knew the same afternoon who killed Emmett Till.
Gotcha.
They knew it.
Mm-hmm.
There was never not even the slightest doubt. There's nothing to investigate. The only thing the positive thing may come out of is if they decide to give some kind of financial retribution to the family. But other than that, there's absolutely nothing to investigate. I knew the people in Mississippi knew everybody in that neighborhood where Emmett Till, where the event happened. Everybody knew within the same evening that it happened, when they found out that Emmett Till was dead, who killed that young brother. I was a teenager then. I remember that. In fact, more than anything else, that was the incident that politicized me.
So, and I'm glad you said that, because that takes me to my very next question, which is, there are a lot of people that are listening to this conversation and watching this on Facebook that have no clue what we're talking about. So if you were going to describe the impact of his murder tomorrow morning to a ninth grade class of school children, what would you tell them?
I was 17 years old at that time. I, of course, knew about racism and white supremacy. I grew up in Tuskegee, Alabama. Fortunately, I grew up in a county that was about 90% black.
Mm.
So we did not run into the same kind of intense racism and brutality that other communities, smaller communities, might have, mainly because we had the university there, Tuskegee University.
Mm-hmm.
We also had the Veterans Hospital for all the black veterans in the Southeast was based in Tuskegee. So we were kind of, as a youngsters, you know, we could, unless we went downtown, we could probably have not even see any white folks.
Mm.
When we were very young.
Mm-hmm.
If you got older, you went downtown and things would get more often. But the Emmett Till case, I remember more than anything else at that time. When I opened up Jet Magazine, my grandmother subscribed to Jet Magazine, and I would read it from cover to cover because that was my contact with the national black community. And when I opened up Jet Magazine and saw that picture of Emmett Till, I think that was my first real revealing of what this country was all about in terms of race. It was that shooting and that picture and seeing that picture in Jet. I mean, I will be forever grateful to Mr. Johnson and Jet Magazine for publishing that picture.
And for Mamie Till's courage to say, to plead with Mr. Johnson to show the picture, because I believe she said, you know, look at my boy. Look at what they've done to my boy. I want the world to see.
Well, of course, I found out years later that they sealed up his casket when they sent it from Mississippi to Chicago, and basically almost tried to threaten her about not opening it.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, no way. I want them to see what they did to my baby.
Mm-hmm.
And when I met her in 1997 for the first time in person, and I went over to her and I said to her, thank you very much for having the courage and the determination to make sure that we saw what those white supremacists and racists had done to your son. And I want to thank you, because for me, that was my eye-opener to the true racism and white supremacy in this country.
And Emmett Till was killed 4 years after William Patterson's charge to the UN, We Charge Genocide, in his book, his petition to the UN, where he documented very carefully and very accurately documented the cases of African Americans having been indiscriminately lynched and killed by other means. And William Patterson went to the UN. Then 4 years later, Emmett Till is brutally murdered. Can you give us some correlation in just the few minutes we have? Give us some correlation between what we were experiencing then and what we're dealing with now, with the death and murder of Anton Rose II in Pittsburgh. And as Gil Scott-Heron would say, the the endless list that won't be missed when at last America is purged?
Yeah. Well, you see, I think what most people don't know is that this country to this day, to this minute that we are talking, has never signed the UN Charter on Human Rights. They have never signed it. And the reason they haven't signed it is because of the situation that was happening to black people in this country at that time when the UN was formed and through that period, and even up to now. They have never signed it. That's why when Brother Malcolm spent the last year of his life on a goal of having the United States government take it before the UN Commission on Human Rights, he couldn't do it himself. He had to get a UN member to do it. And he had gotten six African countries, Dr. John Henry Clark told me, to agree to do that. So they have always tried to keep, there, while they criticize everybody else for violating human rights and this kind of thing, they've always had to keep their situation outside, outside of that debate. But they have never signed the UN Charter on Human Rights to this very day. And I'll bet you that 99 and 99% of people in this country do not know that.
No, they don't.
Today they haven't signed it. And I'm talking about Democratic presidents, Republican presidents, liberal presidents, conservative presidents, all across the spectrum. None of them.
And not only that,
signed the the charter, the UN Declaration on Human Rights.
Not only that, the United States is not a member of the International Criminal Court.
Yeah. Well, and that's deliberate.
Exactly.
It is because of us. And because they know they do not want us to have an international vehicle that we can go to individually, to present our case. Like I said, when Brother Malcolm was doing, he could not go before the UN Commission on Human Rights as an individual.
Mm-hmm.
It had to be done by a UN member company. But he was providing them with the information and, and the rationale and the reasoning behind why he was taking this position. So with what Mr. Patterson did and things like that, that was all, Mr. Paul Robeson,
mm-hmm.
Everybody understood that, this thing is international. And that's when they really, when the FBI, the CIA, all of them started really getting, moving on folks.
And Dr. King, when he internationalized the conversation about the U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War.
Right. But even before that, brother, and even more for them, even more dangerous than that was that I read about 6 weeks ago, I read Dr. King's entire speech that he made when he got the Nobel Peace Prize.
Yes.
I had never read the whole speech.
Oh, okay.
I read the entire speech. And in that speech, Dr. King, this is January 1964, he talked about connecting the civil rights struggle in this country.
Yes, he did.
With the anti-colonialist movement happening among, and his words, our black brothers in Africa, our brown brothers in South America and the Caribbean, and our yellow brothers on the Asian continent. He said that. And I think that played from then on, I think they started looking at Dr. King with a whole different light, because this was very similar to what Brother Malcolm was saying.
And also, I'd love to get your take on this. I think that's why in President Obama's Nobel acceptance speech, he said, and I'll paraphrase, but I'm going to be pretty close to a quote. He said, "I stand here on the shoulders of Dr. King. But I am the president of the United States, and I have a different responsibility." And I think that got by a whole lot of folks.
Yeah.
But when I heard him say that, and I had read Dr. King's speech,
yeah,
I interpreted that statement as his saying, "Do not even try to bring that conversation to me, because I'm not going to have it."
That's another one of the reasons, brother, that I think one of the things of which I am most proud as a black person is that I did not vote for Obama in 2008 or 2012.
That's a hell of a statement right there. Please elaborate.
I do a lot of reading, brother. I try to keep up on top of things, and I refuse to get excited about someone about who I had barely heard of in 2003, being elected president of the United States in 2008. It took some big boys to make that happen, and I want to know who they were.
Continue, please.
And I heard, now I didn't hear him say this myself, but a reliable source told me that that Reverend Jeremiah Wright said at one time that Obama was selected before he was elected.
Oh no, I heard him say that. Yes.
I didn't hear him say that. And I want to know who did the selecting. And I did not know to this day, and I was not going to vote until I found out.
Well, here's what we do know. We do know he was then and is today a corporatist.
Yes.
We know that.
Yes.
We know he's a Wall Street guy.
Yeah.
So we can start with Goldman Sachs, and we can start there if we want to try to figure out who it was at the time that was behind him and continues to be. I mean, when you look at the bailout, the bank bailout, that's why the banks were bailed out. Nobody went to jail, and the homeowners were left holding those toxic mortgages.
Again, as I said before, I consider it one of my proud things of which I am proud, is that I did not vote for him in 2008 or 2012. I did not vote for his opponents, but I also did not vote for him.
I understand. Your point is well taken. I want to draw the connection between the death of Emmett Till and the current rash of murders by police officers of unarmed African Americans. A lot of people, when this issue gets discussed, they want to still talk about these things as though they happen in a vacuum, instead of understanding it's not a bunch of bad cops, it's a systemic problem.
And this is where I kind of get a little bit of, I get mucho criticism. My response to what is happening today with the police shootings, with the more overt expressions of white supremacy and racism that is going on now, and all of those things, this is what my response is, brother. This is what happens to a group of people who resolutely refuse to organize a national movement to promote and protect their interests.
Say it again, please, and why that is so important.
This is what the things that are going on now, including the police shootings, the more overt racism that's being practiced now on numerous white college campuses. People feeling free to say certain things they would not have said, let's say, in the late 60s and 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
Openly saying things.
Mm-hmm.
All of this, I respond to this with this. This is what happens to a group of people, us, who resolutely refuse to organize a national movement to promote and protect their interests.
There are those who would say, but we have the NAACP and we have the Urban League.
No national organization to promote and protect our interests. None. And all those people who are ready to run out in the street and rant and rave and demonstrate and chant and all that kind of stuff, I'll bet you if you ask them to pledge $20 each so we can get a building in downtown Washington, like Brother Malcolm said, we should have a lobbying building on K Street, just like everybody else has.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll be ready every single day to present what we consider our interests on every kind of subject, economic, cultural, political, you know, to whoever we need to put it to. I'll bet you couldn't, all these people who rant and rave and scream and yell and wail and moan about, oh, how terrible, what are the police doing this and police doing that and this happening, and they're going to do, if you ask them to pledge $10 a month to help do this, you probably will not get 15%.
So when you say $10 a month, basically what you're asking people to do is sacrifice one cup of Starbucks coffee a month.
A million black people put up $10 a month so we can have a building here in D.C. whose purpose is to look out after our economic, cultural, and political interests in this society, and be ready to move on in on Congress and anywhere else when those things are violated.
Now, this next question, I'm sure you get this question a lot, and it may be a stupid question, but I'm the king of stupid questions. You are the person I know who was the closest to Brother Malcolm that I can talk to. Looking at where we are now, what do you think would be the three most salient points that Brother Malcolm would be pressing today?
I think one, he would be telling us, as he said, that we need to organize an independent black political party in this country. I came across a recent quote by W.E.B. Du Bois, in which he said, "May the gods write us off as asses if we connect ourselves to either the Democratic or the Republican Party." And I know that Brother Malcolm would be advocating, number one, an independent black political party in this country. Number two, he would be a strong promoter that we pay much more attention to economics. We, as a people, have collectively enough money to do anything that we need to do to promote and protect ourselves in the society. We might not have enough money to do everything we want to do, but we have sufficient funds collectively to do everything we need to do. Brother Malcolm said this over and over again. So he'd be very definitely pushing a strong economic type of activity. And then number three, he would have created by this time a serious national black publication. He told us over and over again, it is no way that we should think for even a half a second that the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, MSNBC, Fox News, CNN, CBS, NBC are going to promote our interests in this society. We have to have our own communications vehicle to do that. And I think that he understood this clearly. People don't know he was the one who founded the Muhammad Speaks.
Mm-hmm.
He founded, he was a journalist. He wrote a column that used to run in some of the black newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
Practically everything you see under Mr. Muhammad's name was written by Brother Malcolm.
Now that I didn't know.
Was written by Brother Malcolm. Because he was the journalist.
Gotcha.
In this arena.
I need to stop you there. I'm up against the clock. I got to stop you there.
I think that those three things is what he would be doing.
I look forward to having you back. There's a lot more for us to discuss.
Okay.
Brother A. Peter Bailey, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate you coming to the Critical Hour.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Take care. Bye.
You know, people, I read this story, and when I first read the story about Emmett Till, they reopened the investigation, I said, oh, that's great. And then I asked myself, why? And that's when I called Brother A. Peter Bailey, and he made it very clear. It's a media ploy. That's all it is. To his point, what is there left to investigate? We know who did it. We know why they did it. And they're all gone. You've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. Thanks to all of you who are joining us on Facebook. We greatly appreciate it, and each one tell one. I hope you are informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all tomorrow right here on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.